Emotional gut punches, hard as nails boss fights, and deep diving fan theories. Welcome to this special Final Fantasy VII Rebirth edition of the PlayStation Access Podcast. Hello and welcome to the PlayStation Access Podcast, the official podcast of PlayStation UK. I am Rob Pearson, your host. Joining us today, we have Rosie Caddick.
Oh, first name and surname. This is a very formal introduction. Hello.
Isn't that why you're in trouble?
Yeah, oh dearie
me. It's because it's a special day today, because we have a special guest. Amy Mallett is also with us. The reason Amy joins us today is because Amy is a big Final Fantasy fan, much like myself, much like Rosie. And it's a special edition of the podcast today because we are diving into Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. This is a special one-off spoiler cast talking all about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. So here is your warning. If you have not yet finished Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, stop watching and or listening to this right now. Go and finish Final Fantasy VII Rebirth and then come back, because we are going weapons free. Everything in the game is up for discussion today, and probably we'll also be talking about Final Fantasy VII Remake. I don't know why you would have finished Rebirth and not Remake, but you know, if you've not finished Remake, if you've not played and finished the original Final Fantasy VII, if you've not played Crisis Core, if you've not watched Final Fantasy VII Advent Children, all of those things may come up in this podcast. So with that out of the way, I've been holding on to this for so long, not being able to talk about this openly in the office in case someone who hasn't finished it yet hears. Mm-hmm. We're now in a safe space where all three of us have finished the game. I wanted to just kick off the discussion. We'll get to the ending later. I wanted to kick things off just by asking everyone, what was your favorite bit? What was your favorite chapter?
So many bits.
This was really hard because when I saw Rob gave us a couple of questions just to prepare for in advance, and when it was like, what's your favourite chapter? I went through all of them and literally I was there thinking...
Such
I love-
a rosy thing to
I
do.
I was like...
One, two, three.
Yeah, but I was like, what happens
track,
in each
though,
chapter?
Don't you? This, yeah. It's such a massive game.
Because they all just flow together. And I was like, I love this part from this chapter and this one from this and this one.
Well, that's all right, Rosie. You don't have to say... Just what a collection of your favourite bits.
Okay, well, probably... Well, I did decide on a favourite chapter for the whole thing. And I think my favourite chapter is chapter 12, because that's the chapter where you go back to the Golden Saucer and you have the date sequence. Mm-hmm. And the moment when you're in the theatre absolutely blew me away.
Oh my God,
I have a real soft spot for... theatrical productions, and when I was watching the sequence that you have, it reminded me of the Honeybee Inn in Final Fantasy VII Remake, where you're just embracing this massive show, and I loved it. I loved Barrett in red, like the villains of the story.
It was absolutely amazing. That bit really did blow me away. Yeah. When you had to choose between, like, who is your love?
Yeah.
And just hovering over people, and they're all like...
Yeah, like, even the villains are like, ooh.
Yeah. Barrett's like,
oh, and because Barrett is high camp, and I love it when they really panto up Barrett's like performances, because his voice actor as well is just incredible, like so good.
So that was definitely like, so you had that part in chapter 12, and there was also a moment with Zach and Marlene where Marlene's telling Zach a bit more about Aerith's death, and
is that the scary man is going to kill her bit?
Yeah, it's like scary man's coming in, and she's like, you have to believe me, and Zach goes, it, you know, after everything that's happened, yes, I do believe you. And that's when he decides that he has to go to visit Hojo to get a cure for Cloud and Aerith as well. There's just so many things. I remember witnessing that chapter, and there were so many things I was like the whole time. I think that one really stood out to me. And then you've got the epic fight sequence at the end in the like arena, so that just is one that really, I was like, oh, this is a good chapter.
I mean, that boss rush at the end of chapter 12.
Yeah.
Flipping heck. I enjoyed chapter 12, but it took a lot out of me. When you're like, okay, I've beaten Don Corneo and his pet now, that's over. And then the Turks come along. Mm. You're like, oh, all right, game.
Yeah.
I've beaten three fights and Don Corneo and the Turks. And then Rufus comes out, literally the hardest boss in the entire game, in my opinion. Oh,
the solo fights in general were just unforgiving. As soon as you're one party member by yourself, everything is just like so much more challenging to think about how you're going to conserve your health, how you're going to kind of like exploit the strategies and the weaknesses. Because Rufus took me a while to get as well, because it's the counter thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like if you just go straight for him, he counters you straight away.
You can't touch him.
You have to stagger him when he's going to reload. But yeah, it's so much harder when Cloud's suddenly on his Todd and all of your mates are just standing
back.
They're
just gone.
Well, Cloud getting up off the floor takes longer than Rufus reloading. So you've got to be good at dodging. You've got to be able to dodge his attacks and then quickly get in. That fight took me a good 5 or 6 tries. I'm not ashamed to admit. Really tough fight, but really great. I mean, the music throughout the whole game is incredible. I love Rufus's battle theme. Yeah. Very cool.
I won't lie, when Rufus first, like, when he appears from the ground in the arena, it immediately gave me flashbacks to doing hard mode in Final Fantasy VII Remake, because I remember in Remake, I thought Rufus was the toughest boss there.
Yeah, massively.
And so as soon as I saw him, I thought, oh.
Yeah. And it's not coin, even just Rufus,
he's going to use that coin again, and there he goes.
Plumbing coin toss, yeah. It's not even just Rufus, is it, though? You've got Darkstar as well.
There's a bit of respite when Darkstar came out, because I thought, here's something I can hit for a bit. I'm just going to constantly dodge me. It's like my ATB was just as soon as Darkstar came out. I was like, this is easy now. Rufus on his own, that's the problem.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
What about you, Amy? What was your favourite chapter? Oh,
just like you, I really struggle with this question, because there were lots of elements for me about Costa del Sol that I thought were brilliant. Mm. I thought Costa del Sol really brought the levity. It's really giving like your mates on holiday, the fact that they all go and get changed and kind of like go and take part in mini games. And there's a real sort of like break from the kind of epic quest that is the chase for Sephiroth during that moment in Costa del Sol. So I loved that. But I think my favourite overall was probably Gongaga.
Gongaga as well.
Gongaga for me. So I love Zack. And if you haven't played Crisis Core, I mean, it's feasible that you might have got through Remake and through Rebirth without playing Crisis Core. Crisis Core is brilliant.
So good.
So good. I played it on PSP back in the day and it's fantastic. I keep telling Robert Pearson to play it because it's so good.
I didn't have a PSP when it came out, so I didn't play it. But I was so interested in it that I looked up what happened.
I'm sort of aware
of the story beats, having never actually played the game myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's something I always mean to go back and try, especially now that it's...
Now they've got a reunion version out.
PS4 and PS5. So I've got no excuse, really. But yeah, it's always been a bit of a black hole for me. Anyway, please go on.
No, I was just going to say, so for that reason, Zack's origin story is very close to my heart. So visiting Gongaga in the detail that you get in Rebirth as opposed to sort of OG was something that was really fascinating to me. That scene where Aerith speaks to Zack's parents is just, so much more intense.
I love that bit.
Because obviously, like she doesn't know if he's dead or alive and she goes back to effectively speak to what would have been her in-laws. And that brilliant scene when she comes out and Cloud's kind of like, you know, forget about him. He's probably dead. He's probably got loads of women. And it's sort of very bitter from Cloud because obviously he quite likes Aerith. And that love triangle almost becomes like a love quadrilateral, I guess, at that point, because you've got Zack and Tifa and Aerith and Cloud all together. And obviously Cisne as well, who's in Crisis Core. My girl Cisne, she's fantastic. And she's a really cool character. She used to be a Turk. Now she's kind of just like the, you know, running Gongaga's kind of military, isn't she? Like private army. That was really cool. And then you have, on top of like discovering Zack's hometown and all of those little parallels of Cloud and Zack, you then have the Gongaga reactor, which is insanely cool. That's when
stuff goes down in that reaction, isn't it?
Oh my God, a major story deviation from the original, because Cloud obviously attempts to kill Tifa, attempts to just slash her up when she's at the top of the reactor and she falls into the live stream. It's very reminiscent of what happens, I think you said to me actually, in Medeal. I'd kind of forgotten about that from the OG game.
Yeah.
But that memory journey that you go on.
And there's a bit where she's inside the weapon and she's sort of like piecing together memories from Nibelheim that is very reminiscent of the scene in the original game where Tifa is helping Cloud
figure out who he is.
I believe he falls in the live stream in Medeal and has like major Marco poisoning for a while. But definitely echoes of that scene in that
massively
segment.
Yeah, and you see the white whispers, the black whispers. It kind of alludes to what's going to happen at the ending, which we'll get to in a moment. But yeah, I thought Gongaga was brilliant. I thought it had the fight with Scarlet is tough as nails. That is a really, really tough fight. And I just think, yeah, that section was kind of really where it escalated for me. You saw the weapons in action. Yeah. You saw what was really at stake. And you kind of got really awesome flashbacks to, you know, Zack's life. There's even a side quest that I loved where you find Zack's little personal training gym where he used to yeah. come. And Cloud teaches the guy to do the little Zack squats. And
oh,
it's
yes.
super cute
yeah,
and awesome.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah. That was great. Did either of you do the side quest with the chicken?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, literally.
God. Can we talk about how that last chicken can get in a KFC bargain bucket, please?
Yeah, but it does. That's the great thing.
Yeah.
The ending to that quest, it's all like, oh, I've saved the chicken. And
after
then the owner of the chickens is like,
fate.
How about some roast chicken? Yeah.
It gets so dark,
it's
doesn't
so
it? Because all of a sudden it goes from this adorable little wholesome granny to like them all outside looking like Red's face.
Yeah, Red's
literally like,
I've questioned
I've seen
life.
Some stuff.
I mean, I thought it was great because, like, the final chicken is like miles away from the village.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, I'm not luring that thing all the way back.
How
with
long
a can
did you lure
on
it
a string
before you realised that you weren't supposed
well,
to?
I wasn't gonna do it. I was messaging Secret Boss, like, I'm not doing that. I can't even remember the way back, and he was like, just give it a go, .. And so I did it, and then immediately that fight happens.
Yeah,
I was like,
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
That's better. But yeah. the ending of that side quest made me laugh a lot. The game made me laugh a lot throughout
yeah,
the whole
it's,
thing.
Oh, it's hysterical.
Anyway,
it's really, really
so
funny.
Characterful and vibrant. Did you have more to say, Amy, about Chapter 9?
Oh, I've always got more to say. I think Junon was also really good as well. I think Junon's parade scene was just
that,
brilliant.
That was going to be mine.
Yeah. That. Oh, okay, well, then we'll transition across
yeah,
to you so you can talk about it.
Chapter 4, I think... It's a toss-up for me between Chapter 4 and Chapter 13.
Mm.
Chapter 4, the Junon parade bit, specifically the bit where you're walking around as Cloud, dressed in your Shinra military disguise.
Yeah.
I love the scene just before that where Cloud and Aerith and Tifa are all getting changed.
Yeah,
just
that's
very
really
playful,
cute.
Really funny. And then you go out and you have to find all of the 7th Infantry scattered throughout Junon. And that's the kind of task that in most games I'd be like, oh god, here we go, gotta just find everyone. And I approached it with that sort of mindset at first. I was like, I'm gonna be here for flipping ages doing this. After the first one, I was just completely in love with that whole bit. So
yeah.
They didn't, it's unnecessarily good, that
yeah.
bit.
Yeah, yeah,
so full of character, so funny.
Yeah,
you can find I think a maximum of 10 groups of infantry
yep.
men, and they're all doing something funny.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of story attached to each one.
Every single one.
There's
yeah.
a group taking a photo with a cardboard cutout of Rufus, and they ask you to take a photo for them. And if you take a nice photo, you get to keep the cardboard cutout of Rufus.
Mm.
Why Cloud would want that, I don't know.
Why wouldn't anyone want the cardboard cutout of Rufus? I text Rob probably about 4 hours into the game, like, I fancy Rufus Shinra. Is this a problem? And Rob was like, maybe.
Maybe.
I don't know what it says
mean,
about you.
You know, he's part of a big evil corporation, right?
They're all doing something funny. There's a group hanging out in a jazz bar, and the jazz musicians are playing like a full-on jazz cover
yeah.
of a Final Fantasy. I can't remember
yeah.
exactly which piece of music it is, but it's a piece of music from the original game.
Yes, yeah.
And I just stood there listening to it for about 5 minutes because
yeah.
it's genuinely so good, thinking, wow, someone actually went to the effort of creating this bespoke piece of jazz music that
yeah.
a lot of people are probably just going to skip on by
yep,
and
yeah.
not listen
not
to.
Not even think about.
Amazing. And Elena's sitting at the bar.
Oh, I was going to say, and Elena in the bar.
She's leave me alone. I'm busy being sad.
Oh,
so
I've
good.
Clipped that out for social. I love that she's having that day at work that we've all had, because she's got her hands on the table
yeah.
and she's like, Song probably hates me, boss is gonna fire me, I'm busy being sad.
Oh, that's great.
Love her.
And then you go into the special exclusive Bald Bar.
Yes.
Oh, Rude's little hideout.
Rude is
yeah.
there. You see him going in, you're like, oh, what's happening here? Ready for something dramatic, or maybe
yeah.
even a fight. I was like, I'm gonna have to fight Rude down here.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
no, he's in his little Bald only exclusive bar, and they all have a little
yeah.
special thing they do where they
no scalp,
like,
no service,
they squeak their heads. And,
yeah, they've got a song as well, haven't they? It's like
yeah.
Something like Gleam It, oh, rub, scrub it fine, make it shine, something like that, isn't it? And they're all like, even the bartender's singing.
Really enjoyed it, especially, I'm sure you can appreciate why I, in particular, would enjoy that scene.
Yeah, why? Do you like the helmets?
Yeah,
helmets are cool. It's the only place Rude can get any peace from Reno.
Yeah, I felt very seen in that scene. Mm. And it was just, the whole vibe of it was just so joyful.
Funny.
And it was that whole bit, even when you've got all of the infantry people following you around, technically, it was so impressive. Just like 50 soldiers just all marching down the street after you, saying like a different thing each
Every time.
They were like complimenting me on my folios. And all 50 of them were like, first class folio, sir, all doing a salute. I just had a massive grin on my face that whole section.
Same.
I thought it was an amazing bit of world building.
Yeah.
Mm. I thought the whole game was is so effective at making you fall in love with this world.
Yeah, brilliantly.
And the people who live in it. But that bit in particular was great. Mm. And chapter 13, I thought, was just an absolute banger from start to finish.
Temple of the Ancients,
basically. Yeah. So good. Like, the music in the Temple of the Ancients was like a really evocative mix of, some of it was the original theme from Temple of the Ancients in the original game, but there was also a little bit of the Forgotten Capital theme being woven in, like that.
They love doing that with the music,
laced
don't
a little bit in the background. And then the battle theme, which was a little twist on the Temple of the Ancients theme, but battled up a bit. And then the game does that constantly.
Yeah.
The iconic just world map theme, which has been transformed into the battle theme for the Grasslands. Incredible composition.
Yeah.
But that the Temple of the Ancients was just amazing. The boss fights in it, the boss fight against the Red Dragon was so cool. The way it finishes with a really cinematic, clouds like sliding under its tail in slow motion.
Tifa does
a drop kick on its head. Tifa drop kicks a dragon in the face.
Yes.
To finish that fight.
I love Tifa.
What a fight. And then you team up with the Turks. So you've got Cloud, Barret and Tifa teaming up with Rude and Reno to fight some monsters. Mm. And then you get like a little Advent Children's style cutscene where they're fighting each other, and then it goes into a boss fight against them. That whole bit was just great.
Yeah.
That whole boss fight against the Turks in Temple of the Ancients, just a big bit of fan service. I mean, the whole game feels like a huge bit of fan service, but that fight in particular was like, I know the Turks are cool. We know the Turks are cool. We know you love the Turks.
They're my favourites. Have
this really cool fight with Rude and Reno. Mm. It's not in the original game. You don't fight the Turks in the Temple of the Ancients in the original game, but it's like, who cares? Just have a really great fight against them.
It's great for Reno as well, bless him, because he's been out of
Rebirth. He's been on holiday
Gets a little comeback. Oh, it was so good. And then that, you know, that your party's split into two at that section in the game. Mm. So then about half an hour later, you get to fight Zeng and Elena, which is the first time you actually get to fight Zeng. Because you don't get to fight him at all in the original game. That fight has a really cool little jazzy style
Turks theme.
Boss battle
theme to it. Yeah, I love how they weave the Turks theme into everything. They've got so many different versions of that. Da-na-na. Like, there's a real sort of, in the first game in Remake, there's a real guitar heavy one for Reno.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of the jazzy one for Song and Elena. And then, I think you're so right about how they use motifs, how they bring back, because I was constantly throughout the whole game just being like, oh, that's Genova's theme.
Yeah.
Or, oh, that's a little bit of the old battle theme. Or, oh my God, that's that. And it just, I think they're so clever at mixing them together so seamlessly, especially in longer battles as well.
Yes.
Because it must be, just from a technical standpoint, so clever that you can do that and not know when that piece of music like realistically
ends. Well, they
ends.
Have like the different phases to the bosses.
Yeah.
And they all seem to have like different bits of music attached to those phases.
Where it escalates.
The boss fights are all quite big, drawn out, epic, climactic events. Much like in Remake, where I felt like every boss encounter was like a real moment. And those boss themes, they work so well because the game knows you have to go from phase one to phase two to phase three of the boss fight, and the way the music transitions between those phases. My favorite example of it actually is at the end of chapter two when you fight the Midgard Zorma.
Yes.
And you've got starts with the traditional battle theme, starts getting a little bit more epic, and it reminded me of the Crab Warden theme. I think it's a rehash of the Crab Warden theme from Remake.
Yeah.
Then you get to phase three of the fight, and it's like a drum and bass remix of the original battle theme. Yeah. I was like, oh my God. And it did beta, the classic enemy skill move beta, and you get that bit in the fight where the drums are pounding. It does that area of effect move where, I can't remember, one of your party, I think it's Barrett, is like, get off the floor! And you get like a proper floor is lava moment, and you have to get to dry land out of the bog, otherwise it completely wipes you out. But the amount of times where a crescendo in the music would coincide with me doing a really cool synergy ability or a limit break, those moments you just can't. You can't predict, and when they happen organically, you just feel like such a badass.
Yeah.
I remember I finished that snake off with a limit break from Cloud right when the music really kicks into gear, and I just felt absolutely amazing in that moment. And the game just gives so many of those moments to you.
Yeah.
Just
absolutely
amazing.
Absolutely stunning. Yeah. Yeah. I love the way you can sort of, sometimes during a battle as well, I would find myself mesmerized by pausing to issue a command.
Yes.
And you'd pause in a position where Cloud's like upside down, his beautiful anime hair is flowing, his sword's above his head. I just knocked the microphone because I got so excited. And he's sort of like, just the slow-mo of it, and you hear the echo of like Barrett being like, ah, I got this, and stuff like that.
I love it even when you get the echo mid-conversation. Yeah.
The sound design of a fight is different every time. It feels intrinsically like it's your playthrough, which is so hard for a game to do. And yet I just think I can't say enough good things about the sound and the music. The Valkyrie as well is one of our favorite battle themes.
Yes.
I know we always really sort of say that is like a piece of music that in Remake I remembered that piece of music almost more than I did the fight. The fight's great,
yeah,
but actually that like is just like a motif that when they use it, it feels so heroic.
Yes.
And they use it again, don't
they? I think I pretty sure they brought the Valkyrie back just so we can hear that bit of music again. It's like, you know, I should fight the Valkyrie there. Yeah, let's put the Valkyrie in, just because we know everyone loves this bit of music. They used it in the Summer Games Fest reveal trailer for Rebirth.
Did, yes.
They used the Valkyrie theme in
that. Very excited about that.
Just a brilliant bit of music. It was a bit of music I didn't realise I liked as much as I did until I was just listening to the soundtrack for Remake and it came on. I was like, this is great, this bit of music. And
so good. If you're on the way to work, just put that on and you will feel so epic by the time you arrive.
I'm ready to do the paperwork!
Yeah, it's great. I think we've already talked a little bit about this, but I just wanted to ask, favourite boss fight, hardest boss fight.
Hardest.
We've talked about bosses here.
Favourite or hardest?
A lot. Both. I've already said that I thought the hardest boss fight was Rufus in chapter 12.
Okay,
really. Cool. That's the one where I died against him five or six times.
Okay.
No other bosses really took me longer than one or two goes to take out.
Yeah.
But I'm keen to hear what your thoughts about the other bosses are.
I'll let you go first because I think mine transitions into the ending chat a bit well. A bit well?
A bit well.
A bit well. I've been sitting next to you too long. I'm picking up my phrases.
Picking up my random phrases. I think I thought that the yin and yang boss was the hardest. It's the one in chapter 11 when you're...
Kate Sith. Oh my
God. And you are solo Kate Sith and yin and yang has this thing depending on... It's got like two faces and depending on which one it is, it's either physical attacks or magic attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to manage that with Kate Sith, who is a bit of both, but mainly I built my character build was all on luck. So even then, it's not as if I had loads of magic spells or anything like that, because as he joined your party, it's like, oh, here's a coincidental thing to raise your luck. I thought, okay, his benefit is going to be he's going to have some really strong powers if he has luck. So I was fighting that fight. I knew exactly what I had to do, but still, yin and yang does give you a good old few punches.
The hardest fight with Kate Sith was when you had to fight two of those scale monsters.
Yeah, those as well.
On that a stupid amount of times for a normal enemy, you know, for not a boss.
Yeah.
And I had to use the Moogle as damage control. My poor Moogle was a little fluffy punching bag. I just kept summoning him so that he'd get beaten up.
You fully
so
have
Kate
that panic
right.
where you fall off the Moogle and then you're like, where's my Moogle? I need it back. Or it's like you have to build up your ATB again to summon up the fat Moogle.
I love where's my Moogle?
Where's my
Moogle? Did I park my Moogle?
I remember that boss being pretty tough because already we're just learning how to use the character with their build and things like that. And now it's you're up against a tough boss fight against it with these two switching gameplay styles. So I remember that one being particularly tough, I thought. And also the electricity moves. I remember I kept on like blocking them and trying to dodge them at the right time, but he's not the fastest mover, so when it came to like thunder like dropping down on me, a lot of time I just got slapped or zapped, and I remember dying on that one a good few amount of times. So I think that was probably the boss I died to the most, but we got there in the end.
Cool.
What would you
we
say?
Always get there in the end.
Always get there.
Always
get there in the end.
We persevere. Say what you like about us Final Fantasy fans. We persevere.
We get there in the end.
So do you want my hardest? Yeah?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So my hardest was actually Sephiroth, the very last fight in the game.
I've heard some people having problems with this.
I'll tell you for why. I got to the point where the game in chapter 14 is like, right, this is your last resting spot.
Yeah.
After this, you and your characters, you're going to rush to Aerith's side. So equip the materia that you want, you know, sort out your gear and equipment, be ready because this is your last stand, your last chance to alter anything. So I put every bit of materia, obviously, that I needed on Cloud and his party. I didn't put anything on Aerith because I thought, well, she's possibly going to kick the bucket.
Oh, dear.
And also, it kind of implied that, you know, we were going to get to her, but she might not have been in the final fight. You can see where this is going.
Yep.
So when we got to Sephiroth, right, she comes out that portal and she's like, oh, I'm so radiant. And I'm like, you've got Breach equipped to you and that's it. And nothing else. I think she had cleansing. So she could cast Poisona and she could cast Breach and that was it.
I had Boss with a similar, he was like, he was messaging me saying, I can't do this bit. Like, Aerith, I've not been using Aerith. She's still got starter level gear on.
Game?
I was like, what are you talking about?
Secret boss, that is appalling. It wasn't
shame.
That.
That's for sure.
It wasn't her gear. It was just I hadn't equipped any decent material. I hadn't planned for her to be in that final fight.
Well, you get the, you know, the funny thing is when you lose a fight in Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, you're presented with like a list of four restart options. And it's not always clear which is the one that takes you back.
Restart just from this
to the
battle.
Just to that battle you were just doing, or which one takes you back like to the start of the whole sequence.
Yeah. Restart from checkpoint, restart from last battle, restart from last battle before that, restart from this battle
restart
before
from
this
beginning,
before that.
The beginning of the battle.
And the thing is, there's one death animation that Sephiroth does where I think it's like the Octo Slash, because it's his limit break, isn't it? He does Octo Slash and he absolutely annihilates you. Like, it's just so many different sword slashes and uppercuts. And if you get caught in that, you can't sort of dodge or roll away. Yeah. You're just kind of like hacked to pieces and you got to hope that you have HP left when he's done.
Yeah.
He kept killing me and Aerith so much with that. And then there's one bit where he sort of zooms past the camera and cinematically it goes into his face. And it went into his face as I got the game over. So my game over screen is Sephiroth going... And I was just like, this is, because it looked like he was staring into my soul. Like, you're going to have to go all the way back through all these bosses.
I got you, Amy Mallet.
Yeah, and that was the moment when my dog came in, put her butt in my face and was just like, do you want to play? And I was like, not now, Peggy. It was really hard. I struggled a lot and it took me probably about 7 or 8 attempts to do it, just because I kept thinking to myself, if I just go back and I do all of the sort of the Genova Lifeklinger boss and all the other bosses again, it'll be fine. Put different material on Aerith. I've got it made. But I was stubborn. I didn't want to go all the way back through all those bosses. So I just did like God knows how many attempts until I finally won.
This is interesting because this, I think we'll be talking about this particular bit of the final boss fight later in the podcast. Because I think I've gone down a bit of a rabbit hole since finishing this game.
You and me both.
And there's something about that final bit where it's Cloud and Aerith versus Sephiroth. Aerith's really good in that fight.
Yeah.
I quite often switch between characters when I play it anyway. I know some people like to play it differently. They will control maybe just Cloud and input commands and other characters when their ATB is ready. I'm like constantly flipping between characters.
I like to control whoever.
If I'm doing commands on someone, I like to control them for a bit. Switching to Aerith, like you can stop Sephiroth doing those attacks by destroying his Masa Mune or destroying his wing to just clip him a little bit,
vulnerable,
make him a little bit
magic,
weaker,
isn't it as well?
And Aerith absolutely annihilates either the sword or the wing,
the Masamune,
much more effectively than Cloud can.
Yeah,
and there's, you know, there's maybe stuff going on in that battle that could be relevant to the story, or it could be people who I've been watching on the internet taking things a little bit too far. But I really enjoy all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I love that you've got a tin hat that's shaped like Cloud Strife's hair.
I've got my Cloud Strife tin foil hat firmly on for the rest of this podcast. I've got my board with all my red strings on it.
Are we delving in now? Is it delving in time?
I think it's time to delve in.
Yes, okay.
I just want to start this bit by just asking you, sort of, you know, we're going to talk about our personal interpretations of the ending, because I think the ending is deliberately constructed so as to not be obvious. Like, if 100%. You don't understand what happened at the end, that is absolutely intentional. You're not supposed to. You're supposed to be discussing it. You're supposed to be having your own interpretations of it. But before we get into that, I just want to ask you sort of just your initial emotional response to what happens at the end. Mm-hmm. How did it make you feel?
Man, I mean, that's like, weirdly, that's such a big question, because if you played the original, we've all had the same emotion with particularly the scene where Aerith gets stabbed by Sephiroth. But here in this scene, but here in Rebirth, not only do you have that, but you don't, because so many things, the game is literally chucking all of your emotions and your thoughts left, right and center. You can't help but just process everything and literally just go like, what is happening?
Yeah.
So I was, if anything, I was more intrigued. I was so invested into what the game is doing with these multiple timelines and how everything's going, and especially between Cloud and Aerith with that initial ending scene with how those two act to each other. And there was a moment where Cloud, you can see him holding Aerith, and Tifa just has flashes of some moment seeing blood on Cloud's hands and then like sometimes it's not. The whole time I was just so like, what is happening?
It's deliberately disorientating.
Yeah. My initial thoughts, even on the final scene, which was really sad, I got a bit teary-eyed when you see like Tifa and Red, you know, when she's like leaning crying, you just see Red just sitting with her. But again, even when, but my, like, you know, my little lump in my throat immediately went when Aerith then touched Red, and even he goes, Aerith?
Yeah.
And then again I was just like, what's happening? So it was a real roller coaster of emotions going, but mainly my initial response was intrigue and oh my gosh, this was fantastic. I want to talk about my theories and what's happening so much. I'd say probably that.
What about you, Amy?
I needed a lie down first. I think one thing that I would say I felt instantly was actually appreciation, because I think what is so brilliant about how Rebirth ends is that it exploits what is such a pivotal moment, not just in Final Fantasy VII, but in video games, in gaming generally, right? There's never been an instance like this in video game history where we, as the audience, know that a character could potentially be killed. Like, Aerith's death was so incredibly crucial to, you know, the original game, and it was such a massive moment that had everyone just like, what? Like, the fact that we know that, it's a real anomaly, you know, for a video game to kind of have that dramatic irony where we as the player are kind of going in like, oh my God, like this could, will it be different this time? Will it not?
Yeah.
And the moment where Cloud is walking up and you're having to hold R2 and L2. So like,
did you hold?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Oh, you're talking for the push. I was still thinking about the, sorry, I jumped too soon.
You know, the bit because he holds it above her head, because we know in the original he goes to kill her, doesn't he? Which is kind of the Genova sort of Sephiroth messing with his head. But that whole section, just, I screamed. I actually screamed at the TV when he knocks him back, because you're just like, oh my God, you have no way of knowing how it's going to go. And I think that's so clever that the developers of the game exploited that wonderful sense of, this has happened before. We know it's happened before this way, but there's no way of knowing which way it's going to go this time round. And that sense of not knowing, I loved. I'm a huge fan of obscure endings as well. Like, I'm a big Lynch fan. I love it when things are so completely muddled and confusing that you have to sit with it for days afterwards to really get a sense of what you think happened. And I must admit that, all night I was just laying there like, I drew a diagram. I should have brought it in. I drew a diagram as well. I was like, Zach, like little sort of stick figure with funny hair. I was like, Zach, Aerith, no, that's not right. Scrub that out. Okay, Sephiroth here. Parrot.
Oh, my favourite character.
I was going to say, what timeline have you been watching?
I think I tried to say party and Barrett.
The Barrett version.
The Barrett version. The Barrett and his party, and obviously everything that happens where you're switching between worlds. It was brilliant. But yeah, I needed a moment to process. And like you say, intrigue was definitely something, but I think appreciation for how clever it was that they've given us this experience, which is such an anomaly in video games, to know that going in. Yeah, it's just fantastic.
I completely agree with you. There was a moment where I sort of like, I wasn't feeling a particular emotion, but I felt an overwhelming surge of just many emotions.
Yes.
When I realized, and it's that moment, right, that you're absolutely bang on, I think, Amy, when it's you're walking towards Aerith. You know the whole game has been building towards this. We've had these unanswered questions now for 4 years since Remake came out, and the ending of that game posed the question, could things be different this time?
Yeah.
I.e., can you save Aerith?
Yeah.
Which, even back in 1997, I remember reading official PlayStation magazine.
God,
there were loads of like cheat articles and codes where like, can you save Aerith?
Yeah, if it was you like do a, this, you might be able to change it.
And, you know, this was before the days of internet guides being able to tell you absolutely everything about a game. Mm. Playground discussions.
Yeah.
You know, kids used to make stuff up. You know, you obviously make stuff about games. And there's a kid in every school who's like, I know how you can save Aerith. Or you can go here into the slums. That guy who's in the pipe, if you bring him a certain item at a certain time of day, you can go to the church and see Aerith's ghost. Mm.
That is true, though. You can see
like a glimpse of Aerith. Yeah. Like a flicker. And yeah. You don't know whether it's like a glitch or a mistake. But this is a question. It made me realise in that moment, and it was the moment where you get to Aerith and the camera pans up and you know Sephiroth's coming down. Mm. That moment, it just really hanged. Mm-hmm. And it was such a loaded moment. I felt all of a sudden not like it was 4 years of wondering what's going to happen. I felt like it was 27 years of this moment has been playing over and over in my mind.
Yep.
And knowing he was about to come down, and like you say, when Cloud was like, no, and he blocks the thing, I was like, oh my God, they've actually done it. Seconds later, going from like, to what? And then she starts falling and she's dead. And then Cloud starts getting confused. And, you know, we've been seeing this from Cloud throughout the game. He's, you know, if you've played the original, you will know that Cloud has the unreliable narrator thing going on where he has misremembered or forgotten or like blocked away the trauma of losing his best friend, Zack. And he's created an alternate reality in his head where he takes the place of Zack and he's the hero.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this isn't new for Cloud. Cloud does this. When bad things happen to Cloud, he's not very good at processing it, and he will create alternate realities where he heroically avoids the bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so immediately you're thinking to yourself, because just before this, you've had Sephiroth show you literally the true nature of reality, as Sephiroth calls it, where he's shown you multiple timelines, multiple universes, multiple all converging. And so you've got that in your head. You know that choices can create branching narrative paths, but you also know that Cloud has previous when it comes to
you're so right. This is
creating exactly what- artificial. And so when he blocks the thing, I'm like, wait a second. Has he actually done that? Has he actually done that? Mm. Has he created an alternate timeline where he has saved Aerith? Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was the case.
Yeah.
Probably for a couple of days after I'd finished it. Because what happens after this scene, you know, it's quite confusing. You've got, you know, a contradiction of imagery. You have the rest of the party rushing in. Mm-hmm. They see something different to what Cloud is seeing. They're seeing Aerith dead.
Yep.
They're seeing blood. Sephiroth, you know, after the parry, the sword, the Masamune gets stuck in the ground and then it glitches and shifts and the angle of it changes and there's blood on it and Sephiroth like flicks the blood off and he says to Cloud, I think he says something like you will never see the truth with such clouded eyes or something like that.
Yep.
And you know, and that's confusing as well because you know that Sephiroth is, you know, this is what he does. He lies to you.
He
tries to manipulate you and he tries to. So you can't rely on what Sephiroth is saying either. Yeah. You can't rely on what Cloud is perceiving. And we as the audience are at that moment in the game looking through Cloud's eyes. Mm-hmm. We're looking through clouded eyes at that scene. And so, and it's intentionally like that, right? You're supposed to be left like, have I saved her? Is there a world where I have saved her?
And
the way it puts you inside Cloud's head, initially I was like, oh man, like, you know, we didn't get to see the scene where he lowered it into the water.
And I think there's a reason for that.
I do
think that's significant.
Yeah.
Absolutely there is, because Cloud, the implication, right, and I think we've gone on to interpretations of the ending sort of naturally here. Mm. The implication is when it goes to that scene and they're all sitting around the lake and they're all mourning Aerith's death, we don't see Cloud lowering Aerith into the water because Cloud doesn't remember that happening.
Mm.
Cloud has blocked that out.
Yep.
The implication is he has just done that, I think. But we don't see it because Cloud hasn't seen it, because at that stage of the game, he's refusing to believe that Aerith is dead. He's doing the same thing that he's done when Zack died. He's creating an artificial reality to protect himself from that emotional trauma.
So Do you think then that that is the nature of the fact that he can see sort of Aerith alive? Do you think it's fictitious and it's him repressing the truth? Or do you think that there is actually a timeline? Effectively, it's can we trust Cloud being the unreliable narrator? Mm-hmm. Or knowing what we now know about the multiverses, is it that there is... Because you do see when he pushes the sword back... There is that big cloud of kind of what looks like... I love how the multiverse is depicted actually in this game. It's kind of like an oil spillage, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like rainbow effects. Yeah. And it's full of like shards and textures and fragments. It's really colourful. You get a flash of that as he does it, which makes me think you see that whenever a portal opens and it's implying a kind of multiverse thing. So I do think there is quite possibly, you know, that it might be that they opened up a branch there... By defying fate, we know that by defying fate, that's what happens. It splinters off. So quite possibly he could have done a different timeline. But what makes me really nervous is that when Cloud is holding her, the flashes that you get of her alive, her not alive, is very similar to what you get when Genova is revealing the truth to him or clouding his memory or kind of like causing him to suddenly remember things that were repressed in his psyche. So I think it could be either or. And I go back and forth on whether I think Cloud himself has just witnessed her death and is blocking it because that's classic Cloud. And also it would make sense with where the story could go, but also I think there is also that possibility the timeline thing is something that won't leave my brain.
I think
they're keeping your hope dangling, aren't they?
I mean, I don't think there is any way, I don't think there's any other way they could have ended this game because
it's so
they
good.
Can't wrap things up. We know there are plans for the third game in the remake project to come, and you go through all of these emotions. You feel like, oh, I wanted to see that particular scene, or I don't know fully still whether Aerith is alive or dead. Clearly she is dead in at least one, at least the main timeline.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Barrett and Tifa in Red 13, Kate Sith, Yuffie, Vincent, Sid, they're all reacting to Aerith dying. But yeah, and it's intentionally throwing up that question, but did you save her in one? Is there a branch of reality where Cloud did save her? Or is Cloud just losing his mind? I initially thought the former. I now believe that he didn't save her at all. I think she's dead in all timelines. And I think there are certain things that happen. So when you're going through the multiple timelines with Zach, and you realise, okay, there's not just two here. There's like, oh, there's a different breed of dog. Johnny's coming out with like a plushie of like a different breed
there's
of
like
dog.
There's like four different stamps.
There's a bunch of different. Yeah. So if you and I read an article by Alex Donaldson from VG247. He's like one of my go-to guys for Final Fantasy stuff. So if you're not aware of Alex's work, I'd really recommend checking him out. And he wrote an article for RPG Site. Really analysing all of the different strands of reality that are in play at that moment. I think it's like five or six or seven. So there's one where Zach chooses to save Biggs. There's one where he chooses to go to the church where Aerith is. There's one where he chooses to save Cloud. In each of them, it seems to be there's a bunch of Shinra troops after Zach. That's how he dies originally, right? That's his original death scene, which he seemingly escapes at the end of Final Fantasy VII Remake. But the way I interpreted that was there are some events in this story that no matter what timeline you're in, they're coming for you. They're hunting you down. They're inevitable. They're going to happen. And I think Zack being killed or being mowed down by a bunch of Shinra soldiers is one of them.
It's quite Final Destination, isn't it? There are some things that are
fixed. I think so.
Yeah.
And I think this is like a... There are lots of multiverse stories around in pop culture at the moment. And a theme that often ties them together, I think, is what you would call canon events. There are events which have to happen in all of these timelines, and all of the timelines sort of branch off these events. And my interpretation of the Aerith death scene, if you can call it that, is that that is one such event. Like Aerith dying is a thing that has to happen. And I think that... There's definitely that image of the multiverse potentially being created, that visual motif of, like you said, Amy, the rainbow effect happening when he blocks the sword. But I think it's important to realise that just before that, Sephiroth has revealed to Cloud the nature of the multiverse. And so Cloud has it in his head that he can potentially change reality by making certain choices. And I think it's still consistent with Cloud creating an artificial reality. He has created an artificial reality where in one reality he saved Aerith. Mm. That's my interpretation of it. But the beauty of it is I could be completely wrong, and it could be that he has saved her.
Yeah.
But I sadly think that the Aerith's a goner. And that the Aerith that appears to Cloud is, it's either a product of his imagination or, and this is another strand to the conspiracy theory hole that I've fallen down, that Aerith could be like a construct of Genova or Sephiroth trying to manipulate Cloud.
Because
I watched Maximilian Dude, another YouTube creator who I really enjoy listening to about Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah.
He did like a spoiler mode with Easy Allies recently. And he was talking about, okay, you look at Aerith in that scene and she's acting a little bit weird and her eyes are different. And I went back and watched it and it's the kind of thing where if you're looking for it, you can probably see it. Like,
yeah.
I'm not 100% convinced, but there is evidence there
that
it could be that.
God, that'd be heartbreaking, wouldn't it? Not only shattering.
It's dark, right?
Yeah,
it's really dark.
But it's
dark.
Great. And that's what I like about the storyline, that in this particular iteration. But it could just be all your hope is that it's actually Genova all along.
Yes, which would be awful. But that is sort of where I am at the moment.
I
think Cloud is really, you know, just the reaction of the other characters to Cloud as well at the end. Like, you can see in Tifa's face. She's not just sad that Aerith has died. She's sad that Cloud is, like, in a really bad place. You can see she's like, what the heck's happened to
you? Yeah, like the moment where Barrett says, come on, we've got to go. And then Tifa's the last to stand up and she looks at Cloud and he's just, like, smiling. He's looking at Aerith. Yeah. You know he is, but he's in her eye, he's just smiling into nothing. Like, come on. Even though we know that he's looking at Aerith in his mind, and Tifa's just got the look of, oh my God, like, what is happening? Why is he not reacting?
To Aerith's absolutely. Death? And then also the sky as well. Cloud can see the sky, as in the world ending sky. The others can't. He even says to them, doesn't he? You know, don't look up. Barrett's like, at what? So that's another thing as well that I find really interesting. I'm not sure whether, let's hear your thoughts, Rosie, your theory first.
I mean, mine, well, so I'm, you know, as everyone I'm sure is, that everyone's jumping around. Like, even when I was listening to you, Rob, I was like, oh my God, that could be
your,
oh my God, I could be completely wrong.
You bring a theory and then your mate's like,
it's easy to be convinced, isn't it?
Here comes Rosie's rubbish thoughts over here. I interpreted it that there's a mixture. I still think that there are Aeriths in different universes, because one thing, for example, was that you had one version of Aerith who gave Cloud the holy materia.
Yes.
And then in the cutscene with the moment where Sephiroth does stab Aerith, the holy materia in her hair still falls out.
Yeah.
So I'm like, how is that holy materia back in her hair when we saw an Aerith give one to Cloud? So that's
he then gives it to Aerith in his timeline, though, I think.
But he only gets it because Aerith gives it to him in chapter 14 when they're on the date.
Yes,
so that's in a different timeline.
The way that I'm remembering it in my head is the different stamps. So there's Terrier timeline, there's Beagle timeline, and then that one, its stamp is like a kind of Pomeranian kind of dog. That timeline, I think, is that's where they go on the date and she gives him the materia, he takes it, then Sephiroth, you see, comes in the church behind her. And I think the implication there is that he will kill her. And I'm wondering if that was maybe, because the thing is, I thought, oh, that makes sense, that's what Marlene said, you know, don't let her leave the house because when she goes, Sephiroth's gonna kill her. But then the initial timeline of Marlene and Zach was the terrier timeline, I think. Like, that was when Stamp was a terrier.
Yeah.
So it's so, there's, like you said before, Rob, there's at least, just from dog breeds, there's four different multiverses. So it's quite obvious that what they could be showing us at different times might belong to different.
For sure.
When you have Biggsy in the pug chips and he gets shot, that's obviously another timeline.
Yeah.
And Zach gets ganged up on by the soldiers again. So yeah, I think, I basically, long-winded way of saying, I'm with you in that I think there could possibly be other Aeriths out there.
I think there is.
I think, because again, this is where I was saying, I had my initial theory, which I thought, oh yeah, okay, I think this is my theory with, you know, you have the choice with Zach when he's saying, do I go see Biggs or do I go see Hojo for Cloud and Aerith? And that's already establishing that there's three. But then in my head, I thought, what if there is a timeline where Cloud does save Aerith? But then in my head, I was like, hang on, in Zach's timelines, both of them are ill in bed at the moment. So how is it that they would have got to that point? So, you know, then the idea just, you know, when you're thinking and things just start growing, I was like, what if there is like a fourth timeline?
I think there's at least four.
And also when Aerith does come out ready for the fight against Sephiroth, he says, I underestimated you. And that to me was the big line.
Yeah. Saying it to Aerith, he's not saying, Cloud.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, it's a, I saw that as like a sign of also just respect from Sephiroth. Like he's like, aha, okay, so you have learned the ways.
I think you are definitely right, Rosie. And I think this sort of ties into another theory which came about after the ending of Remake, which posited that the Sephiroth and an Aerith that are in play in this game are actually characters from beyond Advent Children.
Yes.
So this is not is not the original Sephiroth from Final Fantasy VII.
No.
This is a Sephiroth who is aware of the branching timelines, aware of the fact that he was beaten originally, and is now coming back to his past, I guess, to try and make things happen differently.
Yes.
And in Advent Children, Aerith is also there, but in sort of like a life stream spirit form.
Yeah.
Like she has a power after death, similar to, I guess, what you'd call like a Jedi Force ghost, where she's able to she's able to project her consciousness from the life stream. And I think that it is that form of Aerith that appears with Cloud during the final battle of Rebirth. I don't think that Aerith there, absolutely not. That is not a product of Cloud's imagination at all.
No, I don't believe that either.
They're battling in some kind of spiritual realm at that point. And yeah, Sephiroth says to Aerith, I underestimated you.
Yeah.
There's that, when Aerith gives Cloud the holy materia at the beginning of chapter, more like halfway through chapter 14, I think that is the life stream Aerith, I'm going to call her.
Okay, yeah.
That's Aerith interesting because she does say, this is my dream.
The Aerith that has already died.
Yeah, she does.
That is an Aerith that has already died in the original events of the game and is projecting her consciousness from the life stream. She gives a full white materia, holy materia, to Cloud because the Aerith in our timeline, that materia has drained and gone
by
clear.
The whispers. The whispers have taken
so
her memories
the
away.
Aerith that is praying at the altar has originally like a clear materia until Cloud comes back into our timeline with the full holy materia that life stream Aerith has given him.
Yeah.
And Sephiroth sees it in the Sleeping Forest and he says,
That shouldn't be here. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's like Sephiroth's like, ooh, Aerith, you're playing like a good hand, good play, Aerith.
Looks like I'm not the only one with knowledge of the multiverse.
The whole thing is Sephiroth versus Aerith.
Yeah.
It's future Sephiroth versus Lifestream Aerith. That's sort of like the main battle that's going on. And I think Lifestream Aerith is the version of Aerith that appears to Cloud in the Sleeping Forest during that bit where she says to him, I will handle Sephiroth.
Yeah.
You need to take care of yourself. You need to handle yourself because, you know, we've seen Aerith be saying things to Cloud like, I'm looking for the real you.
Yes.
So she's aware of the trauma that Cloud is incapable of processing at the moment. She's aware that he is falsely remembering things from his past. That was my take on that.
Yeah.
That there is... there is a version of Aerith, a spiritual projection of Aerith, also in play, who I think is going to be really important going forward.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Aerith from our game, I think, is dead.
I was just going to say, because there's also the scene where after you've had the scene with the black materia and then Cloud and Aerith, you know, he goes to grab her and they fall off the root tentacle tree.
Oh, in the Temple of the Ancients. Yeah,
yeah. By the Temple of the Ancients. And when you wake up, you're in this other timeline, and Aerith is, you know, walking around with Clouds if they're on a date, and then Sephiroth says, like, oh, so this is where you've been hiding.
Exactly.
So as soon as he said that line, I had the idea.
It's Lifestream Aerith.
Yeah, this Lifestream Aerith, or, like, Aerith keeps on swapping places with herself, but they're all kind of
interesting.
They're all kind of like, they know what's happening. So let's say, for example, there were three Aeriths. If they keep on swapping so that you've got the Aerith in the timeline who's meant to die, for example, this going into the timeline with Cloud on this date when the world's going to end. And then that's why Sephiroth would be like, oh, so this is where you're hiding with the holy materia all this time.
Yeah.
That's probably going to be an absolutely, like, I think the same thing. That scene does make me think more about how many Aeriths are there and what's really going on with Aerith, even if there's... because I definitely think there's one that's died, the one that's in the original timeline.
Yeah, 100%.
But then my question is, how many other Aeriths are there? Because then you've also got the Aerith, like we say, with when Sephiroth walks into the church and we don't see anything happen, but it's a big presumption that Sephiroth's going to go shing.
Yeah. I think Sephiroth or other causes potentially might have killed off a lot of the other Aeriths in different timelines. Mm. My take of it, if you go from the moment where you have that awesome Black Materia standoff, mm-hmm. you know, when Cloud is, how creepy is he in that scene as well?
Oh yeah,
Aerith.
Oh, let's horrible. Talk.
I just want to talk, and you're like, oh, yeah. So after they fall, I think they fall into effectively a portal because mm-hmm. the Whispers also can do strange things with yes. time yeah. as well. Yeah. Because we forget a lot about them being the arbiters of fate, the idea that they are there to kind of keep things on track. They fall through, you know, what we can assume is like some kind of portal. Mm-hmm. Cloud ends up in this dream of Aeriths. I don't know if that's necessarily her just being quite whimsical. I thought maybe she was just saying that because this is kind of her last chance to be almost happy because the world yeah. was ending. I was unsure about that at first. But I do think that might either be Lifestream Aerith, or it's just I am slightly also drawn to the idea of multiverse of Aeriths. And my reasoning for that is, so we just going through the kind of motions of it, we see her go on the date with Cloud. She takes him to the church. She gives him her white materia. You have that awesome line from Sephiroth, which is like, ah, this is where you've been hiding in a world that's accepted its fate. I think she is almost being hunted across these different worlds by Sephiroth, mm-hmm. and I think she's kind of hidden the materia in this one.
Yeah. Yes.
He then finds it because obviously Cloud fell into it through a rift, which I imagine both Sephiroth and Aerith have this very omnipresent energy, which yes. I love in the series.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get the impression that because of their kind of connection to the live stream, albeit one being, you know, not of this planet, but, you know, very much, I guess, a blight on the planet's existence, and he fell into the live stream at the end of the original game, so there's that as well. And then obviously Aerith being etc. I think, yeah, that really for me brought home the idea that maybe this Aerith is sort of hiding her holy, gives it to Cloud, he then takes it through to the timeline that we know that all of we've been playing in the yeah. whole time. That's when, obviously, yeah, Sephiroth says that brilliant line, that doesn't belong here. That gave mm-hmm. me shivers. I was like, oh, of
yeah.
course.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, because Cloud's like, oh. Hides it around his back. And then, yeah, gives it to Aerith in our timeline. At that point, she regains her memories as well, because I think a lot of the memories are kind of...
It's the knowledge is bound up.
The knowledge
material,
is bound up. It's mm-hmm. the
ancient
knowledge.
The material is crystallised knowledge.
Crystallised knowledge of the ancients. So I think yeah. when she gets that back, it's almost like she's getting what the Whispers took from her.
Yes.
So she puts that back in her hair. She then goes and does the whole temple praying and everything. And then I think the whole thing with Cloud seeing two versions, I still think, maybe this is the optimist in me, but I think that there is a multiverse that kind of is spawned there when he does that. Mm-hmm. I just think he spawns it. I think he's still technically stuck in the one that he's in.
Yeah.
Another theory I read is that Cloud, because he's now been through the multiverse,
yes. mm-hmm.
has the ability to exist in more than one.
Or perceive it.
Perceive yeah. like, more than one.
So that, which is why he's able to see the rift in the sky, at the end, and
yeah.
no one else
yes.
can.
Because did yeah. you know as well, I found this really fascinating. They patched a bit of remake on the day that Rebirth came out that changes
this, yeah.
the very last line that Aerith says in Remake.
Really?
So when she comes out of Midgar, when they all come out of Midgar yeah. and they've escaped the causeway and they've like broken fate's ties and they're off on their own, she looks up at the sky and in the OG she says something like...
She says, I miss it, the steel sky.
I miss it, the yes. steel sky. In the patch version she says, the sky... I don't like it.
Yeah.
Which is like, is she seeing something that we can't see? So that whole idea of perception, I love how playful that is. Like, is it, you know, a mental collapse? Is it, you know, the kind of the multiverses yeah. and having that effect on you? I also think there's something in tactility as well. In the first game, when Aerith touches you physically,
yes.
that's when you can see the Whispers. Something similar happens when Zack sees Cloud and they cross over in the multiverses.
Yeah. yeah.
He can't see him and he's waving at him and all of a sudden he punches his arm and they're in the same world. So I think something that Cloud and Zack might have experienced in journeying through those, because they're almost yeah. playing Pong with Sephiroth, aren't they? Across the multiverses.
Oh, that bit where you get to do a synergy ability across dimensions against Sephiroth is amazing.
I just love seeing Zack and Cloud together because I also love Zack.
I screamed at that.
So when I did that, I was like, Amy's going to love, if I love this, Amy's going to lose it at this bit.
Oh, it's so good. Seeing them together again, you know, they've both been through so much. The last time they were physically physically together. I mean, obviously, multiverses aside, Zack carrying Cloud into Midgar in the amended timeline. But the last time, really, in sort of the canon as such of the OG is when Zack dies and Cloud holds him, you know, like actually takes his sword off him and, you know, will you be my living legacy? Like he passes on his life to him.
Yeah.
And it's such an emotional moment. And I think that's why Gongaga got me as much as it did. But yeah, I think the Aerith in the final fight against Sephiroth is a multiverse Aerith. So I kind of I agree with both of you in different ways.
Well, I think there are multiverse Aeriths, but I think they all die. And that's why I say my interpretation is that is Aerith dying is an event that has to happen in all universes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But after her death, Livestream Aerith is a different presence.
She's the MVP then.
It's Livestream. You've got Livestream Aerith on one side and you've got post-Advent Children Sephiroth on the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're battling over whatever they're battling over. I just want to say quickly another moment that really got me unexpectedly just emotional all of a sudden was just after Aerith has given like the white materia to Cloud and they're in their spot and she hugs him and she's like, whatever happens, don't feel bad about
it. It's not your fault.
Oh my God, it
and
really got me.
And it's strangely to the player, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's almost like breaking the fourth wall.
This is the other thing I wanted to talk about. Like there's so much going on here that is Sephiroth messing with Cloud, but it's also Sephiroth messing with the audience.
Yes.
And so much about Remake and Rebirth, there's a meta commentary and meta themes above what is happening on a surface level.
Yeah.
So you've got the idea of the reunion, which in the original game is
reunion theory, isn't it?
Everyone who's been injected with Genova cells converges in one spot. And that's taken a little bit further now in Rebirth, and there's the idea, I think, where Sephiroth's talking about a reunion of worlds.
Yes.
Where all of the worlds are coming together and there's like universal life stream. And when a world dies, it returns to that universal life stream. Very much how when people die in the world, their spirit and their essence returns to the life stream.
Yeah.
And also on a meta level, the whole Remake project is a reunion of the compendium of Final Fantasy VII. So Crisis Core, Dirge of Cerberus, Advent Children, the original game, everything is like everything is coming together into one thing.
You're getting a convergence of timelines, quite literally, aren't you?
And I think that's what it's doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's like. Oh my God! When the third game is revealed, when the remake ended, I said I really felt like I cannot wait for the next game, which turned out to be Rebirth. And I don't think I've ever been as excited for a game as I have Rebirth. That has gone up another 10 levels for the next game comes out. My God, I can't wait. Knowing what happens in the original game and the events we're likely to see, just on a surface level, that's exciting. There's some epic stuff that happens. But just knowing that this story is going to come to whatever conclusion it comes to, very, very exciting as well.
Can we talk about one more thing in the ending as well? So first of all, I just want to say the audacity of Cloud Strife to, in that final scene with Sephiroth, to be like, you know when Sephiroth's like, is this fact? Is this fiction? And Cloud's like, that stuff won't work on me.
Yeah.
Not anymore. Hard cut to him sat on a grassy bank. Ooh, black materia. Hashtag reunion. Better.
He puts it in the sword.
I'm my sword real quick.
I'm just going to save that for Daddy Sephiroth later. Oh my God, I can't believe that. Because he's so creepy the way he smiles at it.
Mm.
Is that white empty materia the black materia? Did it turn into that?
I don't.
People are talking about that.
So.
No, I'm not sure.
So. No.
I'm not sure. But then they keep talking about how, you know, the confluence of worlds and one of the goals Sephiroth seems to have is not only kind of dominion over all the timelines.
Yeah.
He wants to converge them into one. He wants one single timeline, presumably in which he wins.
Yes.
That's what he wants. But he also talks about how, because I guess in the original, he wanted to absorb the life stream to be a god.
Yeah.
In this one, I guess he can almost absorb all of the timelines.
He wants to absorb all of time and space.
All of time and space.
And become some omnipresent.
He's got grand ambitions.
Being.
You can't,
he's very
you can't
ambitious,
knock him.
Isn't it?
You
he's
know,
very ambitious.
Got to respect the hustle here.
another thing that I think is being overlooked slightly is Genova. I think Genova's a lot more important than... She's never really explained that fully in the original Final Fantasy VII.
Yeah, just sort of pops up for a fight and you're like, oh, it's Genova again.
This extraterrestrial being that
Harbinger,
came down from the skies 2,000 years before the events of the original game, had a war with the Setra, was like sealed away
until
she was finally unearthed by Shinra, and Professor Garst did some experiments, and then Hojo took over, and
you know how that ended,
and it resulted in the creation of Sephiroth. I think Genova's a lot more important to the story than we perhaps realize at the moment. The mural room in the Temple of the Ancients, where we got those projections of the old battles between Genova and the Cetra. I think that was so much more than what was in the original game.
Like,
deliberately so. And then you've got the expanded backstory of the Black Materia itself as this thing that's been created by the Gi tribe, who, for some reason, I thought this was like a massive story reveal, can't return to the live stream. Which suggests to me that they're not of the planet.
Yes.
That they have to be extraterrestrial
of some kind.
Like Genova.
Yes. And she also can't return to the planet.
I don't know whether it's me looking too much into this, but whenever you fight Genova, the camera like crashes onto Genova's face, and it looks like she's wearing some kind of skull mask, and you see the eyes glaring behind this skull mask, exactly like Gina Tuck. There's a motif there. So I don't know what this is, and I don't know whether it's me just thinking too much into this. I'm thinking there's some kind of connection between Genova and the Gi tribe that is going to be important.
Yeah,
I am looking forward to learning more. Well, hopefully learning more about the Gi, because when you do that whole section in Cosmo Canyon, I was fully like, whoa, okay, what is going on here? This is getting, like you say, a lot more in-depth onto the actual Black Materia itself, which I really liked. And I did feel bad for them when they say, okay, Red, your dad failed us. Can you get us the Black Materia, please? And then Red just says, I'll do it. And then immediately after, he's like, I'm not going to do it.
I'm actually going to do it.
There's another thing that happens there where they say to Red 13, okay, the promise has been made.
Yeah. Mm.
Which is a line. And again, this is probably me looking way too deeply into this kind of stuff. But that was the line that was used by the narrator in the original Final Fantasy VII Remake reveal trailer at E3 2015.
Ooh.
He says, the promise has been made.
No promises
and
to keep.
The Gi say to Red 13, the promise has been made.
Ah, interesting.
It probably doesn't mean anything at all.
I know, but what if it does? What if you're the first one who's like, the Gi are actually incredibly important to what's going to happen in all the timelines?
You heard it first. Rob Pearson's
right. They are
right.
important.
Yeah,
I think so too.
Yeah, and, you know, who knows? But what I love most about, well, there are lots of things I love about this game. I think it's an astonishing video game.
Amazing.
Incredibly brave choices being made by the dev team, knowing how much people love the original.
Yes, yeah, very
how
much
brave
so.
Is it to you know, dare to tweak the most iconic scene in all of video games, knowing that fans are going to be like, what? But I think it's so exciting, and I don't know of any instance in video games before where we've had this story that's going to be told over potentially the best part of a decade.
We
don't know anything about the third game, when it's likely to come out, anything at all. But there was 4 years between Remake and Rebirth. And it's just given us, I love this. I love just
it's so good,
talking.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And you just don't, I can't think of another game series that's done that.
Yeah, yeah.
Typically with Final Fantasy games, they're one and done. You know, they're one self-contained entry.
Yeah.
Occasionally you'll get sequels and spin-offs.
It's normally neatly wrapped up, isn't
it? You know,
it?
The game finishes, and then, you know, Final Fantasy X-2, it's not a continuation of Final Fantasy X per se. Like, Final Fantasy X doesn't end on a cliffhanger. Final Fantasy X wraps up, and then X-2 is released, and, you know, more is added to the story. Whereas this is one story being told over three games, and you've got these intervening years in between where everybody gets to talk about it and come up with fan theories, and I love being feeling
part
like I'm
it.
Part
yeah.
of a of part of that. And
this
not,
is what I meant earlier.
Knowing. It's so exciting.
I love not knowing. Yeah. I love not knowing. Like, I live for fan theories. I live for discussions. Recently, you interviewed Kitase-san, didn't you? And he said he actually reads fan theories, which I think is so interesting, because I love the idea that they're kind of looking at this wider community. Because we've been a fan of this world and these characters for like, I mean, since 1997, I can't do maths very well, but I know that's a long time. 20 odd years, you know, like, that is an insane amount of time to have invested in this world and to still be so intrigued by it.
Yeah.
And I think what you said about, you know, they've played a blinder, they've made a really brave choice with that scene, with that kind of way to end Rebirth. But also what I think is so clever and yet no other remake really has done before is they've kind of given us our cake and eaten it too. Because we're able as fans to have something new to look forward to, which is what I loved about Remake, because, you know, people will have differing opinions on whether or not they should have changed it in parts, whether they should have just kept it completely as it was in the OG. But we've got the OG, you know?
Yeah.
The OG exists. It's already there. You can play it. What's great about Remake and Rebirth is that it really encapsulates that idea that, like, you're going to see some of your favourite scenes in beautiful, glorious graphics. You're going to visit Costa del Sol, walk around it, go shopping in it, eat ice cream in it. But also, you're able to have surprises. You're able to have things that you don't understand. That I love.
Yeah.
Like, they've nailed that balance of, like, here is something that you're going to love revisiting for nostalgia's sake, and here is something that you are going to really rack your
100%.
Brain to understand because it's something new. Yeah. What a treat.
I'm so invested in this story.
Same.
And if they'd have kept it beat for beat exactly the same as the original, I'd be loving it, but I wouldn't be here so invested because I know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
But now I don't know what's going to happen.
Exactly.
And that is mega exciting.
Well, this is the thing as well. When you said that we had 4 years between Remake and Rebirth, I still remember finishing Remake and just the way that it wrapped up that part of the story and opened up the world. You know, the story and how it can go, it still sticks with you. So when I came to Rebirth, I didn't even feel as if, personally, I didn't feel as if I needed to look at a recap of Remake or anything, because 100%. In those 4 years, it stuck with me. And like everyone, we've all been waiting and anticipating, reading theories. It's funny when you're talking about all these theories and stuff, because I guarantee you, if I read what someone else is going to say, I'm going to be like, my theory's completely changed now. Because we're all in this together.
My interpretation of it has changed.
Yeah.
Yeah, just talking to you two today has given me fresh thoughts.
Yeah, I'm like,
I love it. I absolutely love it. I also love, right at the very end, Sid whistles the Final Fantasy ending theme.
Yes.
He does.
And I was
very
like,
nice touch.
Nice touch.
Very nice touch indeed. Mm. Well, I think that's all we have time for. I am going to go back home and just devour every video article I can find.
See, I haven't read or watched anything, so now I'm going to be like, what's everyone else said? I'm like, I am completely wrong.
Well, it's at the moment, no one is wrong, right?
No one
is right.
That's the beauty of it.
And that's so cool.
Yeah. Like, we're all going to work together.
I love it. You know, there are no right or wrong answers at the moment. Like, the ending is constructed to make us like this, right? To make us not know and to discuss. But thank you so much for your time, Rosie and Amy. It's been great to have you on the podcast. Please, in the comments, hit us with your own fan theories on what you think is going on at the end of Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Do you think Aerith has been saved? Do you think Aerith is just dead? Like, what's going on? Mm-hmm. We want to hear what you think. Thanks very much for watching and listening. Do check out the YouTube channel. We've got a bunch of videos on Final Fantasy VII Rebirth and loads of stuff on other cool video games as well. And join us again in another 2 weeks for another episode of the PlayStation Access podcast. Thanks for listening. Catch you again soon.
Bye.
Bye. PlayStation.